You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. And Herds.
Flex.
Welcome to review season.
It's good to be here. It's always nice to wrap things up at the end of the year with a nice bit of reflection. Every good movie does it.
That's right.
And we are a good movie, if nothing else.
Well, thank you. Yeah, this was meant to be our big last hurrah getting in the studio at the end of the year before taking a break. But instead, my immune system decided to just say, screw you.
I was going to be polite, but I have to ask, you sound terrible. Flex, are you doing okay? Are you drinking lots of tea and getting lots of rest?
I'm doing my best. I'm holding on. I have indeed had lots of tea. But it's been a bit of a struggle. I've gotten myself tested COVID negative, so we're all good on that front. But
I'm glad.
God, I look forward to escaping the confines of my room in a couple of days.
I hope the tea you've got is that pomegranate stuff. And yeah, I'm excited just for Christmas times.
Yeah.
It's maybe the best time of the year. That's what I hear. Top three times of the year for sure.
Top three times of the year. Yeah, well, anyway, first week of review season, we have four reviews for you today. We're going to be going through a review of Halloween, Murder on the Way, Death Going Down, and Inspector Imanishi Investigates.
Boy, I can't wait for that Murder on the Way review. I hear it's to die for.
Well, that was the one that you did this week.
It is. It is the one that I've done for this week. I'm very excited. It was a lot of fun to put together, talking about a story that I loved to bits, but... Like, look, there are reasons why it's ended up in the bottom sort of section of the show this year.
Yeah.
Very objective reasons, unfortunately.
Well, anyway, I hope you enjoy listening to today's episode and figuring out exactly the point at which I became sick, because at least to me, it's pretty obvious.
Oh, no. It's a bit of a game for the audience.
But we will see. Well, let's just jump straight into the Halloween review then, Herds.
Let's get into it.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Flex, and welcome to review season. Rather than launch review season this year with a eulogistic scathing of our least recommended story, we thought it'd be fun to start with a review of the seasonal mystery. A couple of years ago, we joined Andrew Popel of Final Draft for a Christmas special where we explored the frostbitten pagan origins of the Christmas traditions and how well that isolation fits into the murder mystery canon. Whilst Spooktober may be larger than it appears in our mirrors, it is another celebration of the grim and gruesome that seems right at home for murder mystery. The modern Halloween traditions of obscuring your identity, threatening strangers, and minimalist vegetable lighting couldn't be any more murder and mystery if they tried. Even the more classic depictions of monsters and the curses of the unknown unites deeply with the core tenet of the impossible crime, that defeat is accepting the barely explicable was in fact supernatural. Trying to summarize the origins of Halloween is a bit of an undertaking, since as with many modern religious traditions, it's a blend of so many other cultures that came before it. You'll find stories of doors to other worlds, ancient battles between heroes and fire-breathing harpists, transitioning souls from death to the afterlife, warding off witches and ghosts, and cultural animosity in the British Isles. In some ways, its diverse lineage stands in polar opposite to the comparatively traceable influences of the writers every marketing department insists on analogizing their hot new mystery authors to. Our particular All Hallows Eve venture for the year saw us taking a journey through those authors, with Poe's DuPont Mysteries as well as the subtly named Halloween Party by Dame Agatha Christie. Whilst the spook value of DuPont's mysteries may be a little lacking, obviously Poe is well lauded as a master of the gothic, and maybe that corner of his mind is what made him perfect for pioneering the criminal conundrums we love so dearly. The grim union of death that pairs both fields of fiction needs no explanation, but perhaps less easy to see is the sense of curiosity, a search for meaning in inexplicable things, be it the haunting story behind a grotesque facade, a miscarriage of justice, or the feeling of loss stemming from an acquainted death. This year's BAD, Sydney Crime Writers Festival, saw a panel between Solari Gentil, Robert Gott, Mark Brandy, and Radio National's Bookshelves' Dr. Kate Evans talking about crime fiction as the literature of resistance, wherein they discuss the idea that our genre inherently stands to challenge and resist the whims of society, be it Roland Sinclair's resistance of 1930s fascism, Brandy's resistance of our views of the disadvantaged people in our society, or William Powers' resistance of common sense. It's fascinating to see that idea stem all the way back to Poe with his posturing of a solution to the real disappearance of Mary Celia Rogers in The Mystery of Marie Roget. Whilst Poe's motives in writing this story may not be entirely congruous to us today, his Dupin stories resist the idea that our lives are inexplicable. When read with the treatise on logical thought that accompanied the original manuscripts in mind, Poe was, in his own way, resisting the idea that an audience had to be unengaged from what they read and could partake in both stories and the world by using their brains. Decades later, as we entered the golden age of crime fiction, audiences were in many ways what Poe had imagined them to be, voracious for something to set their minds to. Tragically, in the case of Christie's Halloween Party, that is where the story finds its downfall. No longer were the cheap tricks and superlative confoundments of the detective enough to entertain an audience, many readers were easily able to spot the bluntly recycled plot threads from her other work. Oddly, though, this is almost perfect for the modern Halloween. We're so far removed from a sense of connection to the festivity that many only associate it with the annual repetitions of candy acquisition, fancy dress, and, at least here in Australia, a vague feeling that the only reason we even hear about it anymore is because there's leftover decoration stock from places that actually engage in the celebration. Even if the Halloween tradition itself may be waning around the world, shifting in favor of Southeast Asia's adoption of the holiday as an excuse to get absolutely torrid on alcohol in mediocre excuses for costumes, I think a small sense of nostalgia will keep us, mystery fans, here. Our curiosity for the dark things, our passion for warped identities and otherworldly occurrences, means we may be one of the last bastions of the tradition. It'll be another 6 years before calendars conspire to afford us another Halloween special on Death of the Reader, assuming 2SER allows us to keep the stranglehold we have on the Sunday night at 9 p.m. slot we've enjoyed these past 3 years, but I don't think we could avoid indirectly indulging in the season's spirit through the natural subject matter of our Murder Mystery World Tour. So when it comes to Halloween each year, grab yourself a spooky mystery, sit down with your anthropomorphic vegetable light source, and rejoice in your keeping alive of one of the many cultural touchstones that motivated our beloved genre. You're listening to Review Season, and that was a review of Halloween? Thanks for joining us here on Death of the Reader for 2021, and we hope you enjoy the venture into the wonderful stories we've covered over the year while we're away. Be sure to get subscribed so you don't miss all the fun and recommendations. This is 2SER 107.3.
You're listening to Death of the Reader. This is Herds bringing you to a tale of the unnatural, the supernatural, and the preternatural, all rolled into one spooky package. Coming in as the 15th most recommended murder mystery for this year's review season is Murder on the Way by Theodore Roscoe, a story of zombies, magic, impossible locked room mysteries, and above all, romance. Now, when I was first recommended Murder on the Way by friend of the show Jim Noy of In Gab We Trust, I really wasn't sure what to think. A pulpy murder mystery from the 1930s starring a bizarre undead roaming the moss-covered halls? This sounds completely ridiculous and kind of stupid. And then I took another moment to think about what sorts of movies I like to watch with my friends and poke mostly friendly fun at, and I figured this would be right up my alley, actually, I think. Murder on the Way may sit low on the totem pole of this year's stories, but it is a roller coaster of hilariously absurd violence and plot twists that don't make half as much sense as they probably should. Allow me to explain. Theodore Roscoe is by no means a well-known author, but his pulpy murder mystery is part of a certain genre of fiction that is endlessly entertaining. I think a cult classic might be the best term to describe the tome that lies before me now in studio. We begin the novel with a very simple setup. Our everyman protagonist, Edward Carter Shawl, alias Cart, is trying desperately to finish up a portrait of his charming love interest, Patricia Pete Dale, when a letter arrives informing them that one Uncle Eli, that being the uncle of Pete, has died and left their Haiti-based mansion Mort Noir in Pete's careful hands. Unfortunately, in a blinding twist that nobody in murder mystery ever seems to see coming, Uncle Eli has invited a large number of strange and probably nefarious individuals, including but not limited to an old Nazi soldier, a mustache-twirling deserter of the US military, my personal favorite, two characters who I can only describe as a racist caricature, and a punk. That last one is taken straight from the character list in the book. He's about as important as he sounds. The gatherers for the funeral of Eli are essentially told that whoever manages to survive until the next morning while living inside the mansion will become its owner. And so begins a night of murder, mistrust, and mayhem as the local bumbling police led by Lieutenant Nemo Nassise attempt to keep control of the situation. Spoiler alert, he definitely does not. The story almost becomes a parody of classic country house murders like And Then There Were None, which we also covered this year, with there being no question that whatever horrible, terrible fate awaits these self-proclaimed mourners is what they deserve for their past crimes. Much of what Pete and Kart spend their time doing is just surviving, but the reader can also begin to form a better picture of the why of it all as Pete and Kart kind of travel through the mansion and its grounds. The plot for this one doesn't end up being dramatically complicated, but at least it is consistent. There's a certain charm to it. Even when the topic of magic is brought to the forefront and witches begin summoning pistols from their britches, the novel maintains a level of consistency in its own insanity and indulgence in the violence and the strangeness of the situation. The whole scene is backed by the pounding of the drums in the distance, manned by natives of the island in which our heroes have become trapped. This is about as far as I can get without addressing the toadstool in the room. Due to the era in which it was published and the author's insistence on embracing the more abrasive tropes of pulp fiction, the story has far, far, far too much racism in it for my liking. It makes it difficult to recommend, even if I did enjoy the story for its merits. It's the same quality that makes it so entertaining that makes it hard to swallow in the end. The characters of the widow Gladys and her son Toadstool, these both being major characters and of color, of course, they in particular are described physically and behaviorally to be as abhorrent to the reader as possible. And they are both physically and emotionally abusive towards each other, and the other characters of color aren't too much better. The natives on the island are either stupid, bloodthirsty, or both, although I do have it on good authority that Roscoe traveled to Haiti in order to research voodoo for this text. Something that does come across with some authenticity, thanks to the effort that he's clearly gone to. I think it is less a product of intentional racism and more of taking the tropes to the extreme and not rolling back when we begin to charge over a cliff, though the view as we fall is spectacular. Murder on the Way is a novel that I greatly enjoyed reading as a piece of murder mystery history, and it was the first novel on Death of the Reader, which we got to read along with a guest expert, Mr. Jim Noy, who was always welcome to spend a night in the Death of the Reader mansion. I would like to recommend this text to anyone who enjoys a sprinkling of insanity along with their murder mystery and who can ignore some of the mistakes of a writer of a bygone age. You're listening to Death of the Reader, so please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on our other recommendations. We can only go up from here. This is 2SCR 107.3.
Beside April by Bad Bad Not Good, featuring Arthur Verikai. You're on Death of the Reader. This is review season. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex here with you, and on this entry of review season, I'm here to tell you that my heart is broken right from the very start of our rankings. Our 14th highest recommendation for the year is Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down. This 1954 novel, translated to English by Lucy Greaves and released by Pushkin Vertigo in 2017, strikes a bizarre point for me. I think for the right reader, this novel is uniquely charming, and if anything we say about it intrigues you, please go check it out, because if you are that reader, we need to get you reading this novel. Let's talk about how it landed in 14th place for us. Death Going Down follows the investigation of the death of German immigrant Frieda Eidinger in a small apartment block in Buenos Aires. She didn't live there, and the inhabitants of the building don't know who she was. The police suspect suicide, but some curious behavior and loose threads convince Blasi, one of the two inspectors on the case, to stick around the scene, poking and prodding until someone's mask slips. Accompanied by a suspiciously narrated introduction, a clever waiter of a thematic device, and the occasional poetic aside, your suspicion as the reader is on the top floor from the very beginning, even though neither of our investigators would quite agree with you at the outset. Has the building's caretaker, Andres, been framed, or did he do a sloppy job covering up a murder? Is the disabled Don Augustine a motionless mastermind? Is there any crack in the neatly consistent wall of alibis? Despite coming in with a low-stakes urban cozy, the hallmarks are all there for a classic closed-circle mystery, and Bosco does an excellent job of never letting you forget your suspicions, even while disarming you. The most clever narrative device, right from the beginning, is that the higher you go up the building, the more suspicious the characters are living on that floor. The corpse is in an elevator called from the 6th floor, found by the person on the 5th, who arrived before the person on the 4th, with the following floors each having fewer opportunities to have committed the crime, right down to an entirely absent family on the ground floor. You are challenged to spend the entire novel grappling as to whether this thematic device will be subverted or just... verted? The main disarmament Bosco uses is Blasi's casual journey from suspect to suspect. You know he's there for information, but he does as good a job feeling unassuming to you as he does to his marks. From asking for a simple photo development, to adopting the victim's dog, to almost asking a suspect out on a date, his gentle approach gets him into situations that a more openly investigative character would never find themselves in, and Bosco uses it to great effect. The unfortunate side effect of these side ventures is that it becomes a bit difficult to not sideline some of them by the end, but maybe the real mystery was the stories we lost along the way. One of the things I liked most about the novel was its confidence in putting in odd asides, internal thoughts, and inexplicable observations in front of the reader, sending your best guesses to the basement of busted theories with ruthless efficiency. Of course, you can still challenge it with the classic unreliable narrator, but then you've only dug yourself a deeper grave. You learn a lot about the characters from their internal responses to quiet moments, and assertions to their motivations you wouldn't get in many other novels. Despite how effective these are, we felt the stylistic choices became more poorly employed the further the novel went on, which is a shame, because I actually really liked the approach. It's the kind of issue that I'd expect to temper on if I was to revisit the novel in a few years over a morning cup of tea. I also think it might be a wise choice to crack open a book or few on Argentinian history post-World War II, before or as you read this, because the book is littered with the cultural aftershocks of the war and colonialism, and there's undoubtedly a lot more depth to everything if you go in armed with a bit more context. The final thing that I found myself wrestling with over the course of the novel was our detective duo. To the best of my atrocious Spanish, I understand that Ericourt and Blasi both feature in her later works, together and as a Blasi solo act in some stories, and I'd be incredibly curious to see more of them. Their neither Holmes nor Watson back and forth was oddly captivating in the way it felt so normal and competent, in no way similar to Miss Marple as characters, but striking that same non-confronting note that made Marple so easy to digest. You can tell that Ericourt and Blasi were a well-adjusted duo with just enough familiarity to trust one another, but also to deal with their doubts in a straightforward way that really fits the story. As I mentioned, the police start assuming suicide, and Blasi's slow and genuine convincing of Ericourt that the case was otherwise provides a firm foothold that takes us uphill towards a climax that otherwise might never have come. When I think of Bosco's other works being translated, it's the evolution of these two that really beckons me. So, neither entirely ups nor downs, really, for this 14th place ranking on review season. It's a solid mystery that feels right at home on our list, a unique set of clues to find its solution in an ordinary setting that I enjoyed, but wasn't hooked on. When a book this reliable is 14th on the list, you know we've had an astonishingly great year. I do hope you, at home, eyeing a copy of this book, are the mystical intended reader, because it will have a cherished place on your shelf. Maria Angelica Bosco's Death Going Down is out from Pushkin Vertigo, translated by Lucy Greaves, and takes out our 14th most recommended spot on review season this year. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Get subscribed to the podcast so you don't miss the rest of this year's recommendations, and thanks for your support this year on 2SER 107.3's Murder Mystery World Tour. You're listening to Review Season here on Death of the Reader. Our 13th recommendation for 2021 on your Murder Mystery World Tour is Seicho Matsumoto's Inspector Imanishi Investigates, also known as Castle of Sand. Seicho Matsumoto is an absolute icon of the social school of Japanese detective fiction, which prioritized real characters and motives over the tangled intricacies of the Honkaku, or authentic school. Whilst Matsumoto's most famous book by far is Points and Lines, Inspector Imanishi Investigates from 1961 has become one of his most well-known stories, with no fewer than 7 film and television adaptations, each making their own tweaks to its simple, gripping, and slightly absurd plot. The edition we read was translated into English by Beth Carey and published by Soho Crime in 2003. If you're looking for a slow-paced, thoughtful mystery that thrives on letting its intrigue hang in the open air, this is your stop. Inspector Imanishi Investigates all kicks off with the discovery of an elderly gentleman's body, his face crushed beyond recognition on the train lines in Kamada, Tokyo. Your mystery mind immediately goes, ah, an unidentifiable victim, curious. Only for the following lines to tell you exactly who this man was, where he'd been seen recently, and another entirely different clue about a man he was drinking with saying Kamada, which the police presume is a name, but our detective, Aitara Imanishi, takes a guess that it instead refers to Kamada Station in Akita Prefecture, and makes his way to the town in search of clues. This delivery and subversion of clues isn't a constant throughout the novel, but I think it adequately warns you how different this story is going to be, at least compared to some of the other exposure you might have had to Japanese mystery masters. Upon arrival at Kamada, Imanishi finds himself on the trail of a young man who visited recently and stood out to the locals. As the thread begins to run cold and he prepares to return home, we're introduced to the Nouveau Group, a collective of young artists who have made national acclaim for themselves in challenging the standards of their respective fields, forming a boy band-esque clique that cannot help but find themselves in the news. It's only after this somewhat unexpected addition that the novel really kicks off. Our story jumps between asides with the Nouveau members and Imanishi, as this inexplicably small world slowly draws them closer and closer together. I had trouble making sense of garbled, auto-translated websites when we first read the novel, but it turns out the group may be Matsumoto's attempt at a response to early signs of a pure literary controversy, which was a critical backlash to low art and genre-style writing that made waves in Japan's network of authors in the months after this novel released. The historical accuracy of that is a bit hard to nail down from this side of the language barrier, but it certainly was an interesting lens to consider the novel through when I went to reread it for this review. The story takes place over months as Imanishi's sense of curiosity and justice slowly tugs away at the threads of this tapestry, finding himself investigating an entirely different series of cases after one of these threads leads him to a young woman who was seen acting suspiciously on a train. Matsumoto takes this near-tedious approach incredibly on the nose as one misadventure finds Imanishi manually scouring the sides of a railway line for clues, to the point his body almost gives in on him. Fortunately for us, the audience, we don't have to wait out the hours and months that Imanishi spends on this case, but there's a very credible sense of a real investigation that demonstrates Seicho Matsumoto's pioneering of this social school of fiction. From work parties to debating with his wife about how hard he should be working, we're less worried about the layout of the crime scene and more about what leads someone to kill and the determination it takes to keep up with them. Even though the original body under the train can seem a distant memory, we're never allowed to entirely forget it as the scattered clues assemble after each of Imanishi's effortless excursions. There is a catch, though, and unsurprisingly, it's that the mystery in this novel doesn't make for much of the game we love so dearly on this show. There's no shortage of opportunities for you to make predictions, get ahead of the investigation, and out-twist Matsumoto's pen, but I think you might come out the other side feeling bewildered and a little flat, especially if you went in expecting a signature Japanese fair play novel, including one detail in particular that had our inbox a bit busier than usual upon its unveiling. You'll know it when you hear it. The value of the puzzle here is more in its engagement with the novel's themes, but that is also where its sharp edges show. In many ways, Inspector Imanishi Investigates and its social school of detective fiction was the 1960s bridge to the future of crime writing and its gritty realism, and less the bridge to a different golden age of mystery that many readers expect of Japan's crime fiction. In short, this is a great novel, a pioneer of what has become a mainstay in modern detective fiction, fittingly reflective of the Nouveau group it explores. It's easy to see, reflecting on this novel, how Seicho Matsumoto became such a cultural institution in Japan. I also, without saying anything of its content, want to observe how deeply satisfying I found the ending of the novel, in a way I felt could easily have fallen flat, tidily executed for a novel so vast in its setting and chronology. And that is 13th place for review season. Suna no Etsuwa by Seicho Matsumoto, translated as Inspector Imanishi Investigates by Beth Carey, is out with Soho Crime. If this is your station, I hope you enjoy your stay in Seicho Matsumoto's capable hands. This is Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour, here on 2SER 107.3.
There you have it, Herds. The end of an agonizing but nonetheless enjoyable reflection on review season. Any short things you wanted to say on the stories I spoke about that you didn't?
Oh my goodness. I don't have much to say about Halloween. Death Going Down, obviously, I enjoyed reading, but I know that when we were kind of ranking Death Going Down, you really hammered home to me the idea that, like, maybe somebody out there will enjoy this more than we will. You know, like, it's not a complete travesty, like Murder on the Way.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the items in this list are definitely like for particular readers much more than general audiences.
I mean, that's the fun of murder mystery. If you think you've found, you know, you have a friend or a family member that might enjoy a specific murder mystery, maybe just grab it for them. If you think someone might enjoy Death Going Down, show it to them. See what happens.
Yeah, know your target audience. Anyway, that's all the time we have here for review season. Hopefully next week, I will have recovered. This has been Death of the Reader, week one of review season. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to 2SER 107.3.